And so I would like to welcome a very special guest to our program today. I'd like to introduce Mark Armitage. We've spoken a number of years ago, Mark, so I'm sure a lot has happened, but welcome to Scripture on Creation.
Well, thank you. It's really great to be with you. And yes, it's been some time and there's a lot to catch up on.
Yeah, you've got a paper published, a very exciting paper where you weren't using electron microscopy so much, but ultraviolet autofluorescence microscopy. We're going to talk about that paper published in September of this year, 2020, in just a few minutes. But Mark, why don't you first let us know what your background is and catch us up on what you've been doing the last few years.
Sure. Well, in a nutshell, I got bit by the microscope bug when I was 16 years old and living in the Caribbean. Actually, my first language is Spanish. My dad was a Marine and we were stationed in Latin America. So the first 18, 19 years of my life were pretty much in Latin America. But I got a chance to travel to Maine, off the coast of the state of Maine.
From the Caribbean to Maine.
Yeah.
That's quite a move.
Well, that was just for the summer. I went to the National Youth Science Foundation where I got exposed to microscopes there on this island off the coast of Portland, Maine. And then that followed me into my college career. I ended up at the University of Florida as a sophomore and was studying biology and plant pathology. And I think I accumulated something like 164, 165 credits towards a bachelor degree. And then I met the Lord. And, you know, I got converted. And, of course, I'd grown up in a very religious, quote-unquote, family. But there was no relationship with the Lord. Mm-hmm. And so my parents, my family withdrew their support from me. And I had to enter the workforce.
Wow.
But I entered into the neurosurgery department at the University of Florida Shands Teaching Hospital there, and I trained neurosurgeons, practicing neurosurgeons, on how to use an operating microscope to operate on the brain and the vessels on the brain. So that was kind of my introduction into applied microscopy. And then I entered the workforce, and about 13 years later, I went back and got my bachelor's at Liberty in education. Then I got a master's in biology and electron microscopy at the Institute for Creation Research Graduate School, which used to be in San Diego, but they closed it down. But I studied under Richard Lumsden, who was the dean of the graduate school at Tulane for many years. And when he became a Christian, they threw him out of Tulane. But he trained me in electron microscopy, and so that's what led me to the first paper, which was published back in 2012, based on the soft tissues that we recovered from the Triceratops horn, a 48-inch long horn at the Hell Creek Formation in Montana.
And that's when you were at California State Northridge, right?
Correct, yes. Okay. I was running a million-dollar laboratory in the biology department. It was the biological imaging facility. It was at the top floor of the brand-new 50-some million-dollar Chaparral Hall.
Wow.
And so it was the crown jewel of the biology department, and I was running a suite of microscope rooms up there at the top. I had three electron microscopes and a lot of fluorescent microscopes and almost a half a million dollar confocal microscope.
Mm.
And then I went on the dig and I collected my data, and one of the founders of the department, who was the editor of Acta Histochemica, kept begging me for an article. So I submitted the paper on the soft tissue and the Triceratops horn, and 2 weeks later I was terminated from my position. So it was quite an experience. You asked previously how that ended up. Well, the university ended up settling with us out of court because we, through discovery, found emails. This is why discovery is so important. You know, when you get into court, you're adversarial in court, and you need the judge's support.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to work hard. You got to work hard to get the discovery and go through it. They dumped 30,000 pages on me a week before the judge said this case is going to end one way or the other. So I didn't sleep for a whole week, but we found a bunch of smoking gun emails that showed that they were plotting against my religion to terminate me from the department. And so we calculated that it cost the university about $1.5 million to remove me from my position.
For goodness sakes.
Which is it's a waste of California taxpayer money. When you look at the records that the department was keeping at the time, my laboratory was exploding. I trained 45 students and 12 PhDs. I mean, my job was to train some of the PhDs also in that department. And so it was a highly productive laboratory. We were having a great time. Everybody's learning and the projects were being done, and they threw all that away. So
the upshot? You said you settled out of court. What ended up happening?
Well, what happened was they asked the judge to adjudicate, to actually rule on the case, and she did. She ruled that they did discriminate against my religion. Huh. And so that the judge said, if this goes to trial, which we were about to, we had already hired all the folks we needed to go to trial, because the university was just dragging their feet, and we were going to trial. And the judge said, the first fact that will be identified in this trial is that you already discriminated against him and his religion. So they figured, all right, that sounds like a losing case. So they settled out of court with us. So there was no precedent other than her judgment that they did discriminate. She did find as a fact that they did discriminate against my religion.
Hmm. So then from there, now you're in Washington State, and what are you doing there?
Well, at the time all this was going on, I was a victim of a disease called trigeminal neuralgia, which is, it affects the trigeminal nerve, which comes off the lower part of the brain stem, and it travels across the cranium into the face, and it terminates in three positions on your face, above your eyebrow, above your upper jaw, and in your lower jaw, and it delivers electric shocks to your face. And it depends on the severity of your disease, but I was getting electric shocks off a 10 pain scale, about 12, every 30 to 45 seconds of every day. So thank God it didn't happen while I slept, so I could get rest at night, but all day long I was being hammered. So I had to get out of the high pressure cooker that was Los Angeles after 40 years of being there. And so I came to what I think is the most beautiful place on earth, Washington State. And, I got brain surgery. I had to, work with the doctors for quite some time to get approval, but I had brainstem surgery in June of 2019.
Oh, wow. So this has just happened.
Yeah. And then in October, in November of the same year, last year, I had open heart surgery. So, it's been 2019 was the year to fix Mark. So now I'm all fixed. And, as you can see, I'm not only ready to go, but I'm going.
Yeah. You're publishing papers right and left. Now, is this with, in conjunction with, Discovery Institute or at a university or how is it that you're doing this research?
Well, we've started a lab and we've started an organization. We're called the Dinosaur Soft Tissue Research Institute. And
how cool is that?
Yeah, it is.
Congratulations. That is wonderful.
Well, thank you. It's we have a board of directors and it's an open board. We're building an organization that others can take over. And, you can just put me in the basement. I'll just play with the microscopes down in the basement. But we've made some fantastic discoveries, and they're ongoing. We have papers in press right now on new things that are just going to blow everybody's mind. But
great.
In this paper that you've just referred to, we kind of added to the current shocking discoveries that are ongoing. For example, the chromosomes that were found by Elizabeth Boatman and her whole group, which included Dr. Mary Schweitzer.
Okay.
Yeah, they found chromosomes that were lined up across a division plate, like in mitosis.
Wow.
It was an artifact of cell death, and so they were kind of frozen in that position.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the first time anyone's ever imaged dinosaur chromosomes.
Wow.
And so that was published at the end of 2019. And so this is a follow-up to that, and we're showing, hey, we're finding some incredible things too. For example, we showed the vein valves. Some of our veins have valves in them because they have to hold the blood in place in order to move it forward to the heart.
Right. Otherwise, the blood would just slosh up and down. So this just keeps pumping it in one direction, it only lets it move in one direction, pretty much.
Correct, pretty much. And it keeps that volume intact, so there's no break in it. And it's really hard to separate vein valves from recent tissue. In other words, if you sacrifice an animal and take out their veins and try to get the vein valves out, they're very difficult to get out. But here we're finding with the dinosaur bones, when we demineralize these bones, and remember this is what's so shocking about these bones, is they're not turned into rock. They're still bone. They still respond to the same laboratory procedures that are performed in hospitals all over the country, all over the world every day. It's called decalcification. Mm-hmm. And so that's all we did. We put these bones in a decalcification solution. They kind of fall apart and all the soft tissues that are in them fall out on the petri dish.
So would you say technically then these bones aren't really fossilized, or what would we say, permineralized? I mean, they really are just sort of bones out there in the dirt.
They're still bones in the dirt. They're not permineralized.
Yeah. Now, 65 there are some, million in fact, years they've been laying around like that.
Well, yeah, this begs the question, you know, how can they be that old? I mean, that all of this stuff begs that question. But now if you look at the first paper that I published, the Acta Histochemica paper on the horn, we showed that the vessels at the center of the horn, there's this huge vasculature at the center of the horn, and it's about a 9-10 inch in diameter horn, 9-10 inches. But at the center, all the water percolated down through those vessels because the horn was sheared away from the skull and it was jammed point down into the dirt.
Huh, okay.
So the part that was ripped away from the skull was completely exposed and 2 feet from the surface of the dirt there in Montana. So all the water seeping in, went through those vessels and permineralized the vessels, but all the bone surrounding it was still bone, and we were able to decalcify that away.
That is,
and you can
fancy.
See those pictures in the first paper. You see those hardened vessels after. If you picture it this way, think about the slab of concrete in your garage, and imagine a whole bunch of plumbing in there. You know what a slab leak is, right? How horrible it is to have to deal with a slab leak because you got to bust up all that concrete to get to the plumbing
inside. To get to the
pipes,
there. Yep.
Well, imagine just dissolving that concrete away, and now you have all the pipes. Well, that's what we did. We dissolved the bone away. The pipes were there, but the pipes were hardened because they were permineralized. But all the bones surrounding them was still bone.
For goodness
still
sakes, that is
all
amazing.
All the soft tissue in them. Yeah. No. Huh. So we called it selective permineralization.
Huh.
But there are many, many. I mean, we've recovered so many bones from Montana in two locations that are just bone. And in some cases, it's almost like coffee grounds. When you take them out of the ground, you have to take the dirt or the matrix from around it to hold it all together, because it's almost like coffee grounds in some instances, but the soft tissues are still there, which is amazing.
Well, stunning. One of the amazing facts you mentioned in your paper was, I think it was 19 fossils that were taken from a museum in Canada were examined, 14 of them were dinosaur fossils, and every single one of those fossils had soft tissue in it.
Yeah, and those were sitting in a museum for who knows how many years or decades.
Yeah, so I remember very clearly back years ago when we talked last time, Mark, you had mentioned that, you know, at that time, we were just beginning to find some soft tissue here and there, but you made a prediction, and it looks like you were spot on, that perhaps most fossils were going to be found with soft tissue in them. In other words, it would be the rule rather than the exception. And it really seems to be the case.
Yeah, no, I'm gratified that prediction is coming true. but the problem is studying dinosaur soft tissues as a career in secular academia is a career killer. So there's not a lot of people really going after this. And that's why we decided to start the Institute, because we are dedicated to one thing: characterizing dinosaur soft tissue from as many digs, as many burial environments, and as many taxa or different types of organisms as possible. And we're well on the road to that. And but we are a 501c3 organization. And if your folks would like to support us, we'd love to have their support.
I highly recommend it. You know, that's one of the issues for this kind of, let's throw it all into one bucket, creation type research. And that is, you know, Christians, and rightly so, want their giving to go towards what we would consider to be the Great Commission type work.
Yes.
Yeah, and yet this kind of work is important in the field of apologetics, which has an important role in the Great Commission. So somebody that's leaning towards, oh, I wonder if I should help that kind of work, you know, I highly recommend that you consider that, because it's not getting funded dramatically by any means, but every dollar that would be given to this kind of research would have a real impact on putting information out there to the not only Christian community, but to the secular community, ultimately.
Right. And
you know,
one of our goals is to publish in secular journals, which is what we're doing, and to present at secular meetings, which is also what we're doing. It's kind of closed down now with COVID, but once the vaccine is prevalent and, you know, we get herd immunity, we'll be able to start going to these meetings again and presenting this information. Mm-hmm. But the Dinosaur Soft Tissue Research Institute is a different organization than most organizations that Christians are familiar with. We're all volunteers. None of us earns a dime from this. In fact, we end up spending all our money to support this work. And as the Lord gives, we dump it into Distri. But and He's blessing. I mean, last year we spent more money than we dreamed we would even receive, but we were able to spend it, and we give everything away. We don't sell anything. You know, I'm really convicted when Paul talks about we're not like those who peddle the gospel. That really convicted me, and I thought, man, you know, the Lord walked through all the villages and talked and shared and just gave Himself away. Why can't we do that? Why can't we give everything away? We give our papers away. We print our books and we give them. When we go to do a talk, we go to do it for free. And we give away at least 100, maybe 200 books every time we go. So we believe that that's the pattern that the Lord laid down for us. And so we're following that pattern.
Wow, that's excellent. Well, to a case in point, as far as the type of journal that you're publishing in, this one that we've touched on is published in Microscopy Today. And let me read the title again: UV Autofluorescence Microscopy of Dinosaur Bone Reveals Encapsulation of Blood Clots Within Vessel Canals. Now, that's a lot of information, but one of the things that I think would be helpful to try to get at the significance of this work that you've just published, again, it was in September of 2020. One of the things that you focus on in the paper is something called thrombosis. Now, for the listeners who don't know exactly what that is, thrombosis is the name of the cascade of biochemical reactions that result in the formation of a blood clot. Now, if I understand correctly, Mary Schweitzer, you've already mentioned her, she was the pioneer, really, in the discovery of dinosaur soft tissue. She went to great measures to prevent thrombosis in her experiments as she was looking at this dinosaur tissue and then checking out, or let's say comparing ostrich blood and chicken blood with dinosaur tissues. Her experiments were designed to show how dinosaur tissues could be preserved inside fossil bones out in a natural environment for millions of years. And what I wonder is, why did she want to prevent clots from forming in her experiments? And of course, what your paper was showing is they do form. So why did she want to prevent them?
Well, here's the thing. In order to get the end product, which is tissue preservation, you have to have a mechanism. You can't explain the presence of tissues for 68 million years, which is the youngest age for a dinosaur. They get older from there.
Right.
And I'm telling you, we've gone into Permian material, which is 300 plus supposed million years old, and it's got the same structure. In fact, the preservation seems to be better the further back we go in time. But anyway, that's an aside.
Oh, well, that's not an aside, though. I mean, this is just pointing out. For the people that whose heads may swim at all this, the point is, listen, when we can demonstrate that obviously something within a rock has to be on the order of thousands of years old, and yet all the dating techniques point to it being millions of years old, what does that mean? That means that these dating techniques and the ages that they're coming up with are wrong. And this is something that evolution cannot tolerate. So anyway, this, you know, Permian material with soft tissue in it, it's laughable. But go ahead, I digress.
Yes. Well, so in order to explain it on a deep time basis, you have to have a mechanism that can explain the permanence of these tissues over time and what stabilizes them, what holds them together. Because even Dr. Schweitzer has commented in her papers that it's astonishing to find the level of preservation that we're finding, because autolysis alone, just the normal breakdown of a cell, programmed cell death, they call it, will deconstruct soft tissues quite easily. And this is one of the things we demonstrated in our paper, is that some of the structures we're looking at are so thin, they're so delicate, they're so tiny. These bone cells are called osteocytes. And, you know, we've published now 3 or 4 papers on osteocytes alone. But we free these cells from the bone. When we decalcify it, these cells come out. And you can measure their little connections. They have these little thread feet that they use to connect to each other. And so every cell in your bone is connected to and talking to all the other cells in your bone, because they're measuring your real-time compression as you're running, walking, carrying things, exerting force on your limbs. And so so these things have to talk to each other, and they do it through these delicate thread feet called filipodia. And some of these are so tiny. For example, I'll give you a yardstick here. A human hair has a width of 100 microns.
Okay.
That's a unit of measurement in science. So 100 microns across one hair. Now, 1 micron of that hair, you imagine taking 1/100th of a width of your hair, that's 1,000 nanometers. Well, we're looking at tissue structures that are 200 nanometers thin.
Wow.
And they're still there, and they're right outside the blood vessels where this iron supposedly was liberated. And, you know, and we'll get back to Mary's experiment in a second, because it's foundational. But we have tissues right outside the blood vessels where that blood was supposed to preserve it, and they have not been chewed up by the Fenton reactions. And when you iron is a very volatile molecule, and it chews up tissue like Pac-Man. I mean, free iron is so highly destructive. And we go through this in the paper. We refer to all the scientific literature at every step through this paper. We show a logical progression in the literature. But these Fenton reactions are so destructive to tissue that they destroy more tissue than they supposedly preserve. And so in her experiment, they had to collect the blood. As you mentioned, they collected ostrich blood, and emu blood, and chicken blood, and they purified this. They put in an anticoagulant to keep it from clotting. They had to prevent any clotting because they needed the heme from the hemoglobin, which is inside the red blood cell, to be free. But the problem is thrombosis. As soon as you have an injury, even mental stress can cause thrombosis. I mean, COVID-19 is causing thrombosis. People are getting clots, systemic blood clots in their bodies as a result of COVID. So even that kind of stress can cause your blood to clot. And so when these organisms were buried in this flood material, they were being ripped limb from limb. They were under incredible stress, and they drown. And another condition of a drowning victim is that they get blood clots. And so we've looked at these bones. We've now identified 6 different individual dinosaurs, and they all have blood clots in them, in the vessels where the blood vessels were. And so if the blood clots formed in the blood vessels and the iron was sequestered there, this is what our microscopy is showing, then how did it get out into the tissues to preserve the tissues? And like I said, we're finding these thread feet that are 200 nanometers thin just outside those blood canals where this iron supposedly was freed, liberated to go into the bone and preserve all the tissues.
Yeah, the thing is, she proposed that the iron would promote these Fenton reactions, that ultimately the point is that it cross-links the amino acids, and you get this sense of, oh, you got these mighty proteins, they're all cross-linked and they're a lot tougher. But like you mentioned, that kind of hydroxy radical production is going to tear things up way more than you're going to prevent, you're going to make cross-linked protein that supposedly is tougher, right? So this is more than just a catch-22. You're talking about causing something that tears organic molecules up far more than cross-linkage is going to preserve them.
Yeah, and there's other amino acids they could have looked at to see if there was evidence of Fenton reactions, but they didn't look at those amino acids. They only looked at the ones related to elastin and collagen, and only in vessels. So her preservation mechanism is only, and her language is pretty ambiguous. It confers a resistance factor to vessels. So there's no explanation of the osteocytes. There's no explanation of the veins or the vein valves. And of course, we're finding nerves now, and this is what the new paper is about. I've actually thin sectioned dinosaur nerves, and I'm showing the internal structure, which shows that they are nerves. There's no question about it. Mm-hmm. And so, so there's no explanation for the preservation of nerves based on the Fenton reaction explanation. That's only for vessels.
Now, has any other research that you know of addressed her claims that, you know, the iron would promote preservation? I always felt like it was just a wild claim anyway, but as science works, even though somebody makes a wild claim, okay, you've got to try to counteract it. Is anybody else doing the kind of research that you're doing where you are specifically addressing what she claims is a mechanism by which this stuff can be preserved, and you're showing that it can't?
Well, as far as I can tell, it seems like everybody has just accepted that explanation and they've moved on. And
yeah, that's so frustrating.
Well, it's great for me because, you know, if they're going to gloss over this stuff, I'm going to dig into it, and I'll do my work after them and behind them and show the things that they have overlooked. I have no problem doing that at all.
Well, that's great. You're doing some really important work, Mark, and it's really encouraging to hear that you've got this institute. What's the name of the institute again, so people could look into it if they wanted?
It's called the Dinosaur Soft Tissue Research Institute.
Okay.
And we have a website, dstri.org.
All right.
All of our papers can be downloaded from there. We give all the papers away. We have two books out now, two old stretchy books, and those can be downloaded and printed liberally and handed out. We want everybody. Look, people are being lied to, okay? People, their worldview is being confused and muddied and obfuscated, and it's confusing people. But look, if dinosaurs have soft nerves in them, and I'm telling you, they're soft. I made a video, and I'm going to put it up online, of me stretching one of these nerve fibers.
Wow.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
And they're tiny. They're tiny. They should be brittle. They shouldn't even be there. They should be dust by now after 68 million years.
Of course.
But here I am stretching them under a microscope with fine needle forceps. If dinosaurs have these soft tissues in them, which show that they can't be old. I mean, you don't put a ham sandwich out in the backyard, you know, dig a hole, put your ham sandwich out in the backyard, come back in 2 months and expect to find anything. I mean,
right.
Would you expect to find a Gettysburg? You know, we would never dig that up, but would you expect to find, you know, blood clots at Gettysburg after mm-hmm. all those years in the dirt? That stuff should be gone. And it normally is. So it shows that these things cannot be that old, which, you know, there's no getting around the conclusion that this means the Bible really is an accurate book of actual human history.
Yes, absolutely.
These things were all buried in a flood. Our mission is to find as many of these dinosaur specimens around the globe, and we're finding that this encircles the planet.
Yeah, so I think that is crucial. The idea of not just finding them in Montana or in Canada, but all around the world, to show that this is a global effect and it's consistent. Dinosaurs all around the world died in a rapid inundation, and they have not been dead that long. And this is fascinating stuff, Mark.
What it speaks of is the flood judgment. And, you know, everybody today is shouting, follow the science. Follow the science. Follow the science. But in this case, people aren't following the science, and that's why I'm here to show them this science. And this science, if you follow this science, you will come to the conclusion that there is a living God who made the universe, who made the dinosaurs that died in the flood when he executed a judgment against the sin on this planet. And we all go back to one male and one female, Adam and Eve. We are all brothers and sisters. This solves the racism problem. I mean, right here and now, right? If you are my brother or you are my sister in Adam and Eve, we're in the same race. And we should love each other as being in the same family, okay? I mean, that's what dinosaur soft tissue can do for your life right now, okay? Now, the other thing dinosaur soft tissue can do for you is that it can point you towards the coming judgment. And the 2 Peter 3 talks about the climate change that's coming that you're not going to weather. You know,
Radical.
Hugh Austin has he's got a brand new book out called Weathering Climate Change. You're not going to weather climate change because the elements are going to melt in the heat. But everything you see around you right now is going to burn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so that's what dinosaur soft tissue does for you. It helps you realize, wow, God is real. He made me. I belong to him. There's a judgment coming. I need to get my life right with him. That's our point. That's why we're giving this away, because we want people to know, hey, there's a worse judgment coming. And here's the proof of the one that God promised and did bring about.
Well, Mark, I especially appreciate how your work and your passion goes beyond apologetics, but it truly does get to the real key issue in every Amen. Person's heart and soul, and that is they're a sinner and they need the Lord Jesus to forgive them of their sins.
We're all in the same boat.
It's great how everything points to these issues of salvation ultimately. Well, Mark, we could go on for days on this, but I think we've probably given people enough material to chew on for a while, and I really, really appreciate you coming on the program today, and we'll have to catch up soon again when you get another paper or two published and I have a chance to read them, because this paper, again, I'll mention it. It's UV autofluorescence microscopy of dinosaur bones reveals encapsulation of blood clots within vessel canals by Mark Armitage and Jim Soliday. And it's published in Microscopy Today. And I think if you just Google that, you can Google the Microscopy Today and your two names as authors. And I would think that would come up, wouldn't it not?
You can go to our website, because we have all the papers that we've ever published on
great.
The website.
Give that website once again, Mark.
It's at dstri.org.
All right. And you'll find this information, and share this with some of your skeptical Christian friends. Share this with your unbelieving friends, and you ought to be able to get into some pretty interesting conversations. Most importantly, perhaps it would lead to what we were discussing just a moment ago, the importance of this information and its pointing to the truthfulness of the Bible, whether it's talking about science, history, most importantly, our need for a Savior. Mark, God bless you. It's great talking with you. Thank you once again for being on the program.
Thank you so much, Ben. You take good care and be safe out there, okay?
Okay. Bye.
Bye.